when you are around them, you know there's just something just a little bit different than average. I can think of only a handful of folks that are like that. But I believe that the old prophet that we're going to start our chapter off with tonight, I believe he was one of those type guys. I believe that when you look at old Samuel, you've got a seer that everybody knows he means business and God's all over him. And I think tonight as we look at our passage, I think that what you're going to see is I think you're going to see a man that even though he knows the will of God, he is still concerned and he still has great compassion for the man that has now been rejected. And so I want us to kick in at verse 1 of chapter 16. The title of the message tonight is, Somebody Fetch That Young Boy. Somebody go get that young boy. Go fetch him. And so I want us to pick up with our first verse of the 16th chapter. And the Lord said unto Samuel, How long wilt thou mourn for Saul? The word mourn carries the idea with it of someone that is at a funeral. They have lost someone they care about deeply. Their heart is broken. Just this afternoon, I was talking with a person on the phone, and she was telling me about someone, and she's just crushed because of the circumstances in which she has now found herself. It's not going to be probably long before her whole life is going to be turned upside down. And she's scared. And so there's a mourning that she is dreading. And when I see Samuel and it says, How long wilt thou mourn? Evidently, this has been bothering him for a while. If you look back at the previous chapter, what you'll find is it says to close out that chapter that Samuel came no more to see Saul until the day of his death. So what you've got is you've got Samuel and he goes back home to a place called Ramah. And you've got Saul that goes back to his home called Gibeah. And they don't see each other anymore. But Samuel cannot get Saul out of his heart. And so evidently some time has passed between the fact that God has rejected Saul. And it seems as though that the mourning is just constant. And God finally says, look, enough's enough. I've known of people that have mourned for years. They claim to know the Lord. And I know that there are times when people grieve for long periods of time, but Ecclesiastes tells us that there is a time to mourn, but then there's also a time to be happy. And so God looks at him and he says, How long are you going to mourn? I've rejected him. Now you need to move on. Well, what has he rejected him from? He rejected him from reigning over Israel because of his disobedience. May I just say this? That disobedience is not a recipe for rejection by itself. But continued disobedience is. Every one of us are going to fall at some point. We're going to lose our temper. Our tongue is not going to be controlled. We're going to say something that we should not have said. We're going to do something that we should not have done. But if we confess that and we get our fellowship back with the Lord, God will forgive us, according to 1 John 1:9. But we don't find this in the life of Saul. What we find is we find a half-hearted commitment all through these early years, and really it's even now. Saul has probably been king well over 20 years here. And so it started off great. God had given him some wonderful victories. But now, as the curtain is about to close, at least in God's mind, Samuel is thinking, I laid my hands on him. I anointed him. And yet, God has now rejected him because of Saul's continued disobedience. It was his lifestyle. And if we want to be rejected, all we've got to do is just live a life that is constantly disobedient, and God will put us on a shelf. The Apostle Paul said that one of his great fears was that when he had preached to other people, that he himself would become a castaway. Had nothing to do with being cast away with his salvation. It was being cast away to be disqualified from service, to be set on a shelf, to not be used anymore. Well, I want you to notice, number one, I want you to notice God's mission for the prophet. God's mission for the prophet. He said, quit mourning, I've rejected him, get over it. And he said, you fill your horn with oil, and you go, and I will send thee to Jesse the Bethlehemite. For I have provided me a king among his sons. I want you to notice the little phraseology that God inserted in that verse. I have provided. We won't take time to go back to it, but we could go back to like 1 Samuel chapter 9. And what were the people saying? We want to be like everybody else. We want to have a king like everybody else. And God said, I'll be your king. No, we want a king like everybody else. And what did they look for? They looked for a man with an outward appearance that looked like he could do the job. You got a man that is head and shoulders above everybody else in Israel. But as we will see in a little bit, that's not the standard that God uses. And so he tells him, he said, I want you to know that I have got a guy that is going to be a king, and he's going to be a king after my heart and not his own heart. Well, when I look at these first few verses, we see that Samuel has got a concern. You remember, he has already separated himself in the last chapter from Saul. So what does he say? How can I go? In other words, if I leave Ramah and I go to Bethlehem, I've got to go right by Gibeah. Saul is surely going to have some spies there. They're going to tell him that I'm going to Bethlehem. And he's going to want to know why I'm going to Bethlehem. And so he says, if he hears it, he will kill me. And the Lord said, take an heifer with thee. In other words, I want you to take basically a female cow. I want you to take her with you. And if somebody says, what are you doing? Just say, I'm come to sacrifice to the Lord. Now somebody says, Did God really tell him to lie? Well, I don't think so. Because any time a prophet was going to do a particular duty, if there was worship involved, there was sacrifice that was involved. And so he's just simply doing probably what he's always done, as he was a circuit rider, going to the various locations for the school of the prophets. It was probably a normal thing for them to see Samuel and him have a heifer or have a sheep or a goat that would be going along with him. And when he would go to Mizpah, or if he would go to Jericho or any of these other places where there would be a chapter of the school of the prophets, there would be a sacrifice that would be involved. And so God's saying, just take a heifer with you, it'll be okay. Well, when you get to Bethlehem, he said, I want you to call Jesse, make a sacrifice, and when you get there and you talk to Jesse, I'll show you what you're supposed to do. And once you get there, you shall anoint unto me him whom I name unto thee. And so we see the mission that God gives to his prophet. He's a faithful man of God. And just because he's faithful, though, doesn't mean that he doesn't have some other concerns. I mean, let's face it, he was a man of flesh and blood, just as we are flesh and blood. He was a prophet. Everybody knew from Dan to Beersheba, they knew that in Israel, Samuel was the prophet. I mean, there were other ones, but he was the man. But yet he was still a man. And so he's got these fears, he's got these hesitations, but God gives him the security that if you do what I tell you, you'll have my protection. Well, I want you to know that that promise is still available to us today. The safest place for the child of God to be is in the perfect will of God. And somebody says, man, I just don't know if I were one of the missionaries. I don't know if I'd go to one of those hot spots. Well, if that is the will of God, you're as safe as you can possibly be in the will of God. God is going to give you a protection that you wouldn't have if you were in the most secure building in the United States. Because God has a plan and a purpose for you and me, just like he had a plan and a purpose for Samuel. When I see this man, I see him, and he's simply saying, okay, I trust. I trust. You've told me what you want to do. And so verse 4 simply says this, he did that which the Lord spake and came to Bethlehem. Would to God that we not do the same thing. When the Lord speaks to our soul and tells us, do this, and we go, I just don't know. What we're saying by our hesitancy is, I think I know better. Now, if I'm not mistaken, probably a lot of you in here, when you drive with someone, you prefer to drive. Is that true? I'll be honest with you. If I'm going with any of you, I really prefer myself to drive. You know why? Because I think I can drive better than you can. Now, can I? I don't know, but I think I can. I really do. Now, there may be somebody in here that is taught driver's ed, and I mean, you may be dynamite. You may, if we did a road testing or whatever, you might just blow me away. Many years ago, I drove a school bus for Gwinnett County for a little while. And when it got to the point where I was about ready to kill some kids, I just thought, I can't do this. I've got to get out of this. But one of the things they would do every year, they would have what they call a school bus rodeo. I thought that was great. I'm thinking, we get to drive them buses as fast as we can possibly go. You know what that rodeo was about? It was about safety. There's nothing safe about a rodeo. Somebody getting on a bucking bronco, or getting on some 1,000-pound bull. There's nothing safe about a rodeo, but they would call it, we're going to have the school bus rodeo. Well, then it was the challenge, all right, who can do this and score the most points? You know what? I wanted to be the best bus driver. I really did. And so in my mind, I'm thinking, I drive better than any of you. Sometimes I think, when God wants me to do something, Lord, I think I got a little better plan. Now, if you'll be honest, you've probably had that same thought. Lord, I've had this experience before, and I know that, you know, you kind of lead me toward that way, but I think I got a better idea. And we have that idea. And Samuel, he didn't do that. He said, okay, I don't understand it, but if you're going to protect me from Saul, I'll take that heifer and I'll go right by Gibeah. I'll do it. Not only that, but I want you to look at the latter part, or the middle part to the latter part of verse 4. And I want you to see something else that was bothersome. The elders of the town, Bethlehem, trembled at his, Samuel's, coming. And they said, comest thou peaceably? Now, why would they ask that question? Well, they knew some things. First of all, they had just heard how that just a short time previous, he had taken a sword and he had hacked Agag to pieces. So he didn't have an aversion to killing. I mean, if he thought that's what God wanted, he just, okay, let's get at it. Well, they also knew that he had had a problem with Saul. And he turned his back after Saul had reached out and grabbed that tassel off of his tallit. And he said, God's rejected you. And he turned and he went to his home, and then Saul goes, well, I'm going to mine. They knew there was a riff. They knew that he has to go by Saul's area, his community, so to speak, and they've got spies everywhere. Well, they're thinking, if Saul thinks that we're siding with Samuel with some type of coup, he may come in here and kill everybody. I mean, we know he spared Agag, but he did kill the other Amalekites. He may do us the same way. And so there's a lot of apprehension going on right here. Perhaps it's this. You remember at the beginning of the message when I said, how many of you know a preacher? They just seem to be able to look into your soul, and you know that when they're looking at you, it's like, he can see the sin in my life. That's Samuel. And they're thinking, are you coming peaceably, or are you going to be examining us? Are you going to be knocking on our door and asking our family questions? And so he says, peaceably, I'm come to sacrifice unto the Lord. And what does he tell them to do? He says, well, I want you to sanctify yourselves. What does that mean? That means that you need to go, you need to bathe, and you need to change your clothes. You need to be ceremonially clean before we do the service. And so, my guess is that there's a little bit of time that passes, because verse 6 says that it came to pass. So you've got the people of Bethlehem, most of them anyway, and they go and they bathe themselves and they change their clothes and put on some clean raiment. And so, what does he do? He sanctifies Jesse and his boys. Because you see, the plan is only known to God, to Samuel, and to Jesse and his family. The people of Bethlehem, they don't know anything about it. They just know that the great prophet of Israel is here to give a sacrifice. He's here to worship Jehovah. And so, when he sees, or they see him talking to Jesse, they're just thinking, okay. And then it's as though he takes Jesse's family somewhere private, and other people don't see what's happening. And so the second thing that I want you to see tonight is this, that God's methods sometimes are very specific. There are some things that God expects you to do specifically. All we've got to do is look back and see where Saul was not obedient. He was not completely obedient in the specifics that God had told him to do. And incomplete obedience is disobedience. And it was just one of several instances. And remember, continued disobedience causes rejection. And so we have God's methods are specific. You say, well, how do you think that, preacher? Well, the first thing I want you to see is that there was a specific town. You see, God knew that David was going to be from Bethlehem. So what does he tell the great seer? He said, you go to Jesse's house. He is a Bethlehemite. In other words, he lives in Bethlehem. And so there was a specific town. What do we know about Bethlehem? Well, we know that Rachel died there, Jacob's wife. If you go to Israel today, they have a traditional site, which basically means that the Catholics run it. They want you to give them some money. And they will say, here's Rachel's tomb. We don't really know because we think she was buried just out of town. And so they call it Rachel's tomb. But we do know that at some point she was buried outside of Bethlehem. Well, not only that, but also something else happened there. Do you remember the beautiful story of a Moabite girl named Ruth? It's where she met Boaz. And they had a little boy once they married, and his name was Obed. And Obed had a son, and his name was Jesse. And Jesse had a son whose name was David. And so there in Bethlehem, you've got Ruth. Beautiful, beautiful Ruth. Well, it's popular because David was born there. I mean, let's face it. He's the greatest king that Israel ever had and ever will have until Jesus sits on that throne. And so David was born there. But then, let's not forget, Jesus was born there. Next month, we will celebrate that birth in the city of David, Bethlehem. And so God had a specific town. But he went farther than that. He also had a specific family. He had Jesse's family. Now, we don't know what Jesse's last name was. You know, I mean, I don't think it was Foskey. I have no idea, I mean, how they chose last names. I know that many times when they would choose a first name, it was because it would mean something in the culture of the Hebrews. And so you have Jesse's family, the Bethlehemite. You know, there were many people that were in Bethlehem. There were probably several hundred. Now, it was the least among many of the cities in Judah. We find that from some of the prophecies that are in the minor prophets, places like over in Micah chapter 5, places like that. But when you look at Bethlehem and then all of a sudden you go, well, hey, it's a specific family in Bethlehem. You know, God's plan is getting more and more specific. But not only was it a specific town and a specific family, it was a specific kid. I want you to look with me at verse number 6. What you have is, you've got this little private ceremony. They've called the boys from Jesse's family. And when they were come, that he, Samuel, looked upon Eliab. And he said, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. Well, why would he say that? Well, the reason is because, look at verse 7. God said, don't look at his countenance or on the height of his stature. He's doing the exact same thing that the people of Israel did when they chose Saul. But can I say this? It's the exact same thing that we do today. Oh, we find some guy that's nice and tall with a head full of hair and a mouth full of teeth, and he can just charm the world whenever he speaks. And we go, if that guy would just, you know, give himself to Jesus, look what he could do. Look how handsome he is. Look how gifted he is. Look how talented he is. Man, that guy can do it all. And we look at the outward. And so he says, Eliab, that's got to be the one. And what does God say? I've refused him. He's not the one. I've rejected him. You know, one of the things that I notice when I read my Bible, I notice that God doesn't pull punches. You know, I mean, he's not concerned about our feelings. Sometimes, I mean, it's like, ooh, that's hard. There's not always a lot of tact. And so God said, I don't care how tall he is. I don't care how good looking the guy is. There's something more important than that. He's not the one. Get him out of here. Well, look at verse 8. Jesse called Abinadab. That's the second boy. Made him pass before Samuel. And he said, neither has the Lord chosen this one. Well, then Jesse made Shammah. That's the third boy pass by. Not him either. And Jesse made seven of his sons to pass before Samuel. And Samuel said to Jesse, the Lord hath not chosen these. Now you think about that. Now what's Samuel doing? He's thinking, there's seven boys here. Now, one of the things that some people have tried to insinuate, and by the way, I've got the names of the other boys. You have Eliab, you've got Abinadab, you've got Shammah, you've got Nathaniel, you've got Rediah, and you've got Ozium. And David had two sisters, by the way, one named Zariah and the other one named Abigail. And so you've got all of these boys. Well, one of the things is we find that David was like the eighth generation. And then it says later on that David had, of this particular generation. And somebody says, well, in one place it's like he's got seven sons, in one place it's like he's got eight sons. Well, the very simple explanation is this: one of the older boys died. And so therefore, he would not be included any longer. And so therefore, that's why David comes in that particular order. And so you've got all of these boys, and they have passed by. And so God was specific, and all of a sudden, all seven of them are there. And Samuel is thinking, is this all of them? And then I want you to notice what Jesse says. There remaineth yet the youngest. And behold, he keepeth the sheep. Now I want you to think about something with me. David was so insignificant that when the word came to Jesse, I want you to get all of your boys together here in the house because God wants one of these boys to be his man. David is so insignificant, they don't even invite him. They're thinking, somebody's got to keep the sheep. Let the kid do it. Just let the kid do it. After all, he's just a kid. We don't ever know when one of these kids that's in our church is going to do something magnificent in the work of God. We don't ever know. We look at some kid and we just think, what in the world is going on with that kid? Is the kid nuts? We had a young man many years ago, and he was in our youth group. He rode the bus, and he was just a jokester. Wasn't much serious about him. Kid's name was Derek. Wasn't much serious about the kid. And he came to our youth group and rode that bus, lived down in the old Castlewood trailer park down off of Annistown Road. Well, about 2 months ago, I got an email from somebody named Derek. And he goes, is this the Corinth Baptist Church that used to run buses in Stone Mountain? And he asked me a couple of other questions, and so I responded to it with some things that I remembered about this kid. He was just funny as he could be, but there was nothing spiritual at all about the kid. Well, let me tell you about Derek. He's married with several kids now. He began being a policeman back in the mid-90s. Then he became a city councilman. Then God called him to preach. He went to Bible college and got a doctorate. I'm not talking about a Bible certificate. I'm talking about a doctorate. He began working on the staff of a church, still being a preacher or a policeman. Then he took a church, and tonight over in Alabama, Derek, who was just some kid that just liked to laugh and have fun, tonight he is a faithful preacher of the gospel of Jesus Christ. You don't ever know when something is going to happen with one of these kids in this church, and God is going to do something 15 years from now in their life. We don't ever know. But he was so insignificant, he wasn't even invited to come. Well, what does Samuel say? Send and fetch him. Somebody fetch the boy. For we will not sit down till he come hither. Basically, what he's saying is we're not going to eat until he gets here. Well, the third thing I want you to see is I want you to see God's young man. Jesse sent, brought him in. Now, I don't know how long it took. I don't know if it was an hour. Only thing I know is they weren't sitting down till he got there. Well, God looks on the heart, but he also gives us a description of the kid. The first thing it says that he was ruddy. Now, different commentators think ruddy means different things. Some people think because the word ruddy has the idea of a redness, they think that he had red hair. I don't know. You got good people that think he was redheaded, and if he had red hair, he probably had freckles. Only thing I know is that this time in his life, the estimates are he's somewhere between 10 and 15 years of age. I have a tendency to lean toward the 15. And the reason is because of a couple of other things that are here. And then also because of some of the feats that he has been able to do. But it says he was ruddy. There was a redness about him. In other words, he didn't look like a typical Israelite. Maybe he was a little fairer. If you look, it says that he had a beautiful countenance. You know what that means is? That means that he was a happy kid. I mean, after all, what's he doing? He's just out there messing with sheep. I mean, he's out there practicing with a slingshot. He's out there protecting sheep from wild predators. He's out there practicing his harp. We'll see that next week. He's doing all of these things that just boys would probably love to do. I know when I was an early teen, I know this, I used to love to go to the country. And I'd tromp through woods and I'd go fishing and we'd swim in things that I wouldn't dream of swimming in today. I was down at my mom's and I'm looking at this lake and I'm thinking, I bet there's gators in that lake. And when I was a kid, we used to love to swim in those places. I was talking to one of the men in our church. He and his family are from the Hazelhurst area. And he and I were talking, and I told him, I said, I wouldn't no more swim in those ponds in South Georgia now. I wouldn't do it for $1,000. He goes, me neither. I mean, you go and look at it, and you got snakes swimming right across them. You got turtles popping their heads up all over the place. But man, when you're a kid like that and you're in the country, you're just having fun. And there's no doubt that David was enjoying what he was doing, but his family didn't even have him register. I mean, they got sanctified. They took baths. They got their clothes changed. They don't even tell the prophet that they got a younger brother. He's insignificant. But God doesn't look at him as being insignificant. And so, he's a ruddy fella. He's got a beautiful countenance. I mean, he just smiles. When you look at him, you just think, that kid's been up to something and he's happy about it. Not only that, but it says that he was goodly to look at. In other words, he was just a handsome little boy. Now, most of the time when we look at this description, we do think that he was an adolescent. I mean, he hasn't even got a beard. You know, I guess if he had anything, it would be peach fuzz. You know, I mean, I bet you some of you men can remember when you were just a young teenage boy and you couldn't wait to start shaving. You remember that? I remember as a 5-6-year-old little boy, and my dad would stand there in the morning shaving, getting ready to go to work for the police department. And he'd look at me and he'd say, Dooley, you want to shave? And I'd say, yes, sir, I do. And he took a razor and he would undo it and he'd take the blade out of it, turn it back down. And he'd put shaving cream on my face and he'd say, all right, look in the mirror and just pull it down real easy. And, And you know, I didn't have nothing. I mean, I'm 6 years old. I didn't even have peach fuzz. But I knew it was fun. And then when I got a little older and I got into junior high and then in about ninth grade, all of a sudden there was some little fuzz started coming on my chin. I'm thinking, I'm getting there, baby. And then when you get, like a senior in high school and you're thinking, I am just about to the point where I can grow some sideburns. And let's face it, in 1972, sideburns were in. All right? I mean, they were long, and sometimes if you were really good, you could grow a lamb chop. David couldn't do any of that. He's just a ruddy, good-looking kid that's goodly to look at. Doesn't mean anything to the family. Oh, but he means something to God. Means something to God. Well, what does God say? Arise and anoint him, for this is he. Well, David, what takes place? Next thing he knows, he's having some horn or some oil from a horn put on his head. Then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brethren. I'm wondering what the brethren are thinking. Olab thinking, I'm the oldest, bless God, I ought to be the king. No, because you didn't have the heart for it. David's got the heart for it. He's a man after God's own heart. And God doesn't look on the outward, God looks on the inward. And so, right in the middle of all of these brothers and two sisters, what have you got? You got this kid that meant nothing. He wasn't even invited to the sacrifice. And he's having oil poured on his head. And he's being anointed to be the next king who is God's king. Now, I don't know if you've thought about this. What did Samuel tell Jesse and his kids to do? Sanctify yourself. There's nothing in this passage that suggests when David got there, he did that. You don't find where it says, David, go wash ceremonially, put on something else. No, when he got there, he went in with his sheep clothes on. Because God was concerned about the inside of the boy and not the outside. And he got anointed because he had already been set apart for service by God himself. Well, we'll get to it next week. But after Samuel does the anointing, he rises up and he goes back to Ramah. He goes back home. And where do we find David in the next few days? We'll touch on it again next week, but look at verse 19. Wherefore Saul sent messengers unto Jesse and said, send me David thy son, which is with the sheep. He's gone back to doing what his job was. Do you know that right now in this passage that we just covered, David is 15 years at least from being king. But in God's mind, he's already there. Saul is going to be outwardly the king for another 15 or so years. But God already in his mind has said, he's no longer king. I'm just going to let him bide some time. And remember this. When God thinks in terms of time, it's not like we think in terms of time. 15 years to us seems like a long time, especially when you're young. It's just a heartbeat now, the older we get. But with God, 1,500 years is nothing more than 15,000 years. God is not bound by that. He will work his plan as he chooses. So David is now introduced to us. And for the next few weeks, we're going to see the intermingling between the current king and the future king. And we're going to see some of the things that take place. And we're going to see how that leadership in the life of David comes to the top. And it's going to be that David is going to begin to rise. And Saul is going to begin to sink. And then one of the final things that we'll see whenever we get to the end of Saul's life, we'll see him and he's consulting the occult. And he dies by suicide over on Mount Gilboa. And we'll get to that. Let's stand together. Thank you so much for being here this evening. I do want to remind the deacons about our meeting, so immediately afterward we'll go over to the room.